The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome. Bienvenido to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Mary Marquez, and I am a library coordinator for the South and Central Philadelphia Neighborhood Libraries. As many as you know, the Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity. From its award-winning author event series to its robust resources for new Americans, please visit freelibrary.org/support to make a gift that will help the library continue to produce such transformative programming. And while you are online, please don't forget to sign up for the library card. It's now my pleasure to introduce legendary journalist Jorge Ramos, the award-winning anchorman for Noticiero Univision for over 30 years. He is unwavering in delivering hard-hitting news and asking critical questions. Four magazines has said that he carries near biblical authority, at least in the eyes of his nearly 2 million nightly viewers. He's also host of Show Me Something and the public affairs show Al Punto. He has authored over 1,000 books, many topping bestseller lists, and he writes a weekly column for more than 40 newspapers in the United States and Latin America. He has won 10 Emmy Awards, as well as the Walter Cronkite Award in the United States, and of course, the Gabriel Garcia Marquez Prize in Colombia for his excellence in journalism. In his new book, Stranger, The Challenge of a Latino Immigrant in the Trump Era, he draws for hard data and personal experience to respond to the Trump administration's controversial remarks and policies directed toward Latinos, indeed all immigrants to this country. This afternoon, Mr. Ramos will be in conversation with longtime broadcaster and journalist Tracy Matysak. We are so pleased to have them here today, this afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jorge Ramos and Tracy Matysak to the Free Library of Philadelphia. Bienvenido, Jorge.
Muchas gracias a todos por venir, sobre todo en este día tan soleado. Muchas gracias. Thank you so much for being here. I left this morning from D.C. at 7 in the morning. I thought it was going to be an easy train ride. And a tree fell on the railroad, and it took 4 hours. But I'm here, and that was the important thing. Thank you so much, because I know each one of you made an effort to be here. And I really appreciate it, because these are not normal times. What we are living right now is not normal. It is not normal that a president makes racist, sexist, and xenophobic remarks, and that nothing happens. It is not normal for the Latino and for the immigrant community being attacked and being accused of being drug traffickers and criminals and rapists, because I am not and you are not. It is not normal that after having lived in this country for 35 years, with two kids having born in the United States, and after this country gave me the opportunities that my country of origin couldn't give me, because I left Mexico because of censorship, that suddenly you feel like a stranger in your own country. And many things are changing. One has to do with the fact that there's a huge demographic revolution happening right now. In 2044, everyone is going to be a minority. And many people don't like that. Many people want to make America white again. And that's a nostalgic view of the United States. I believe President Trump and some of his advisors want to take us back to 1965, when about 85% of the population in this country was white, non-Hispanic white. And that is simply not possible, because right now, the non-Hispanic white population is about 60%, and in just 30 years, it's going to be less than 50%. And many people are resenting that. Many people don't like that. What they do not understand is that we are a diverse, multicultural, multi-ethnic country. And for me, that is beautiful, and it's working great. I was checking the other day, about 40% of all the founders of Fortune 500 companies, 40% are either immigrants and sons and daughters of immigrants. So I think we're doing great. But what has changed in the last few years? What has made that the number of hate groups increased in the last 3 years to 954? Unfortunately for me, the answer is Donald Trump. And he reflects what many people in this country are feeling. Remember, he's not alone. 63 million people voted for him. Now, let me make it a little more personal. Well, Donald Trump is not my friend, clearly. And this is what happened. After he announced on June 16, 2015, that he wanted to be the next president of the United States, he did say that Mexican immigrants were criminals, drug traffickers, and rapists. Other people now defending him say, well, no, he really didn't mean that. Well, I don't know what he meant, but that's what he said. And I am not a Mexican immigrant. I'm a Mexican immigrant, but I am not what he's saying. So what I did is I wrote a handwritten note to then-candidate Trump. Nobody does that, but I did it. And then I sent it to his Trump Tower in New York City. But I made a mistake. I wrote down my cell phone number on it. Instead of giving me an interview, he published my letter with my cell phone number on it on Instagram the following day. And then I started getting hundreds and hundreds of texts and messages and phone calls, some of them criticizing me, many of them telling me to go back to whatever, and some of them really funny, sending me songs and asking for jobs and wanted to dance with Don Francisco and Sábado Gigante and things like that. So it was not really all that bad. But so after that, I made a plan. He didn't want to talk to me, but I wanted to talk to him. So we found a place where we thought it was going to be easy to have an interaction with him. New York City would have been crazy. But then we found out that he was going to be in Dubuque, Iowa. Who's been to Dubuque, Iowa here? Yeah, exactly. Like three people, four here. So we went to Dubuque, Iowa. And television doesn't happen. You have to create it. So we brought three cameras. We realized that he interrupts all the time. And I wasn't going to allow that. I was going to ask my question right at the end. And I was going to be asking the question with a microphone, so my voice would be heard in the editing room. And then I would be asking the question standing up. It's a matter of body language. I want to be exactly the same level as Donald Trump. And then this is what happened. Let me show you. I brought the video. Dubuque, Iowa, 2015.
Mr. Trump, I have a question about immigration.
Okay, who's next? Yeah, please.
Your immigration plan is
Excuse
full
me,
of
sit down. You want to call. Sit down.
Mr. Trump, no, I'm a reporter as an immigrant and as a U.S. citizen. I have the right to ask the question.
No, you
and
don't.
This is the question.
You haven't been called.
No, I have the right to ask the question.
Go back to
Univision. No, this is the question.
Go ahead.
You cannot deport 11 million.
Go ahead.
You cannot deport 11 million people. You cannot build a 1,900-mile wall. You cannot deny citizenship to children in this
sit
country.
Down,
and with those ideas,
You are called.
No, no, no. I'm a reporter and I have... Don't touch me, sir.
Please,
don't touch me, sir.
Please
you cannot touch me.
Disruptive.
I have the right to ask a question.
Yes, in order. In
I have the right to ask a question. I have the right
where?
To ask a question.
Where? Let me see it.
It's over there.
So they're coming out, stay out. You just got to wait your turn.
You're very rude. It's not about you.
It's not about
you. Get out of my country. Get out.
This is not about you. I'm a U.S. citizen, too.
Well, whatever. No, Univision, no. It's not about you.
It's not about you. It's about the United States.
No, it is. It's about the United
States. So that's what happened. So there are a few things that I want to point out. The first one is that Donald Trump loves to throw air kisses. And did you notice how he sort of moved his hand, his mouth, to call the bodyguard? So one lesson, of course, is you should never, ever, ever give your cell phone number to Donald Trump. And the other one is that if you see him throwing an air kiss, run, because the bodyguard is coming after that. more seriously, when he said, go back to you, he said that he didn't know me. But somehow he knew that I was working for Univision, right? But when he said, go back to Univision, he really meant, go back to Mexico. And look at this. Hate is contagious. After he said that, just a few seconds later, one of his followers outside, somebody's singing him. one of his followers outside that press conference told me, get out of my country. This is my country. I've been living here for more years than in Mexico. So words matter. We have to be very careful with words. And when President Trump makes racist remarks, it has consequences. Let me just show you a video about all the racist remarks that Donald Trump has made. And think of this. I don't know if he's a racist. I don't know what's in his heart, but I do know what's coming out of his mouth. And this is what's coming out of his mouth.
Sound.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. I think there's blame on both sides. You look at both sides. I think there's blame on both sides.
The grandmother in Kenya is on record as saying he was born in Kenya.
We have a representative in Congress who they say was here a long time ago. They call her Pocahontas.
I have a judge who is a hater of Donald Trump. A hater. Gonzalo Curiel. The judge who happens to be, we believe, Mexican, which is great. I think that's fine. The
president asked, quote, why are we having all these people from shithole countries come here? The president then went on to talk about how they needed to bring in more people from places like Norway.
Are you racist?
I am the least racist person that you have ever met.
Build that wall! Build that wall! Build that wall!
All right, so here's the question. These are not fake news. This is what he said. This is exactly what he said. And as journalists, what should we do? What's our responsibility? And what's your responsibility? When something like this happens, I do believe that you have to take a stand. And when it comes to racism, discrimination, corruption, public lies, dictatorship, violation of human rights, you have to take a stand and stop being neutral. We cannot be neutral when things like these are happening, and that is our responsibility. So this is just part of the things that I wanted to say, and now we're gonna have a conversation here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jorge. Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us on this rather cold, windy, soggy day in Philadelphia.
Thank you.
Jorge, I must ask you, you've watched those videos, especially the one of you at the Trump News Conference, many times. You've relived that experience many times. What does it feel like to relive that? How do you feel when you watch that video now?
When someone tells you to get out of your country, and you know it's your country, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who felt that kind of discrimination, it is your body reacts in ways in which you never expected. It is not only a word. When somebody hates you and tells you, that word stays with you forever. And your body reacts as if you're being attacked. Mm-hmm. And then you have many different options. You can run and you can hide, or you can come back stronger. And that's at the end what I decided to do. Yeah.
You spoke just a moment ago about neutrality. And it seems that you work at the intersection of journalism and activism, right? You devoted a chapter in your book where you talk about the difference between objectivity, which is something that we're all taught in journalism school, to be objective, and also neutrality, and that there comes a time to not be neutral. Can you explain what's the difference between objectivity and neutrality, and when is it time to not be neutral?
I think as journalists, we have to report reality as it is, not as I wish it would be. So if your dress is blue, I say blue, and if there's 300 people here, I say 300. So we are reflecting reality as it is. Then we have a social responsibility that is only ours. And our responsibility as journalists is to question those who are in power. That's why we are journalists. That's the beauty of journalism. And then we have to give voice to those who don't have a voice. That's our responsibility. And I've been asked, and I think it's a fair question, if I'm a journalist or an activist. I think I'm just a journalist. The only difference is that I'm a journalist asking questions, and that at some point, when you are in times that are not normal like these ones, when you're faced with racism and discrimination, I think you have to take a stand, and that's what I decided to do. So I do understand that it's debatable, and that among journalists, is not clearly decided, but the best examples that we have of great journalism have happened when journalists take a stand. During the Vietnam War, in the crisis of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, in the McCarthy era, the best journalists that I've seen decided not to be neutral.
Is it also a function of working for Spanish language TV and speaking mm-hmm. to a community that has a large percentage of immigrants, some of whom may be new to this country?
It is, because it is not the same to be an immigrant or a Latino immigrant in communities when you are not being accepted. And when we said that Donald Trump was being making racist remarks at the beginning of his campaign, or when we said that he was attacking the press, many people were telling me, "Oh, come on, your Latinos are too sensitive." But now it's just Trump being Trump. What you're saying is not true. Just wait a little bit more. He's not going to last too long. Well, I think we were right. We felt that. When he said those things, by the way, the comment that he made about Mexican immigrants is not complete. If you listen to the whole phrase, he goes on to say that most immigrants in Latin America are exactly the same. So he's talking about all of us. And we notice that, we realize that it's not that we are too sensitive, no. It's we are being attacked, directly attacked, and we notice that. And when we came out and denounced that, many people didn't believe us. And when finally he made those comments about asshole countries, and it was clearly a racist, openly racist remarks, we were saying, I told you, and it's already too late. He's already the president of the United States. So the only thing we can do at this moment is to resist, to say no, and to show the world, and to show you, and to show everyone, that we are not what he is saying.
So I've heard you talk about the large numbers of Latinos who stayed home on Election Day, yeah. and how that impacted the vote in many states. And yet, of those who did vote, I think it was something like 29%
yeah.
voted for Trump. Were you surprised at that, and how do you account for that?
I was surprised that so many Latinos had the opportunity to vote. There are 27 million Latinos eligible to vote in the last presidential election, and only 13 million went to the polls. What happened to the other 14 million Latinos who stayed home? What happened? We could have changed the election. We could have changed the result in maybe Arizona and Florida. And regardless of what had happened, on the three northeastern states, it would have been a different election. But 40 million decided to stay home. Why? First of all, is that I think the Democratic Party took the Latinos for granted. They thought they were going to vote overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton and that they were going to win the election. But then they didn't remember that they didn't deliver for the Latinos. Candidate Obama told me in an interview that he was going to introduce immigration reform to help 11 million during his first year in office. And when he had control of the White House in 2009, before Ted Kennedy got sick, Senator Ted Kennedy, for 9 months, the Democrats controlled the Senate, the House of Representatives, and the White House, and they didn't do anything. They chose, it was a political decision, not to do anything. And then Barack Obama, during his 8 years in office, he deported 2.5 million undocumented immigrants, destroying thousands of families, deporting people who didn't even have a criminal record. So I think Barack Obama was an inspiration to many of us. I think he's a historical figure. But when it comes to immigration, he just didn't deliver. He failed us. And that explains why many Latinos decided to stay home. They didn't want to vote for Donald Trump, but they also didn't want to vote for Democrats. I mean, they were saying, come on, you failed us. Why should we go out and help you at this time? So that explains the vote for Donald Trump, and also the fact that if 29% of Latinos voted for Donald Trump, that means that we are not monolithic. We are very different. My son is the definition. My son is Puerto Cuban Mexican American. Many of you have all these strange different combinations. We're not monolithic. We're very, very different. And what 29% of Latinos voting for Trump means is that within the Hispanic community, there are many people who are very conservative. And there's also many Latinos who, despite being immigrants or sons and daughters of immigrants, have decided to turn their backs on those immigrants coming afterwards.
So you have expressed a great deal of frustration with President Obama, and you've really taken him to task about those deportations mm-hmm. that you talked about and about not keeping his promise mm-hmm. about reforming immigration in his first year. So having had some experience now with Donald Trump and the frustrations around his positions on immigration, mm-hmm. how do you compare the two presidents?
Well, I've said what I think about President Obama. Let me say that with Barack Obama, it's very difficult because he was such an inspiration. And despite the fact that we didn't agree on many things, he always came back and invited me back to the White House and always have me do interviews with him. I don't know how many interviews I did with him, but many, many interviews. We didn't agree, but we continued the conversation. Now, with President Trump, it's been completely different because not only he did not answer my letter, he published my cell phone number, he ejected me with a bodyguard, and I believe that President Trump is already the most anti-immigrant president since the 1950s. In 1954, there was an operation called Operation Wetback. More than 1 million Mexicans were deported, and some of them, many Americans, by the way, were deported. They were saying, I'm a U.S. citizen, and they didn't believe it, and they deported them anyway. And about 80 people died when they were deported back to Mexicali, right at the border with Mexico. That was 1954. Since then, I do believe that Trump is the most anti-immigrant. Why? He wants to cut legal immigration in half. The number of arrests has increased 30% in comparison to the last year of Barack Obama. He has made all those racist remarks, and he wants to change the essence of what I think is this country, which is that we're a nation of immigrants. When he says that he wants to cut and end chain migration, what he's really saying is, I don't want more immigrants from Latin America, and I don't want more immigrants from Asia. That's exactly what he's saying. And he wants to go back to an era in which most of the immigrants coming here were from English-speaking countries and from Europe. And that changed in 1965.
Yeah. I want to talk about DACA,
sure.
because the deadline is coming up next week, and we know that there was a bit of a reprieve for Dreamers because the Supreme Court refused to hear the lower court ruling that prevented the Trump administration from ending DACA. But what do you think will happen next? Will this be settled by the courts, by Congress? What happens now?
Yeah, let's remember that the president who killed DACA, let me put it this way. Let's remember that the president who established DACA was Barack Obama in 2012. The president who killed DACA is Donald Trump. And the president who's trying to kill DACA again in the courts is Donald Trump. So when he says that he has a big heart and that he wants to help everyone, that is not true. Now, we had a deadline for the DACA students this coming Monday on March 5th, but that was changed because of the decision by the Supreme Court. So what basically happens is that the whole issue goes to a courts of appeal in California, might be taken in the middle of the spring, and then it'll go back again to the Supreme Court in the fall. So we have a few more months to live, but at the end, there has to be a political negotiation with the Dreamers. This didn't have to happen, but it happened because of Donald Trump. The only political situation that I've seen is that the Democrats were willing to give Donald Trump a few miles of his wall, 350 miles, in exchange for DACA. But Donald Trump rejected that. And you know, it's if he wants a wall, let him have his wall, because almost 45% of all undocumented immigrants, they come by plane or with a visa. And then after El Chapo was arrested, there are many Chapitos making tunnels. I know it's funny, but it's true. Now, and as long as you have 20 or 25 million Americans who use illegal drugs every month, they're going to be drug traffickers in Mexico and Central America sending drugs to them through those little Chapo tunnels. So a new wall between Mexico and the United States, in countries in which, last time I checked, we are not at war, we are partners, and there's a lot of movement between two countries. A wall, it isn't going to help. I was in Brownsville, Texas, 3 weeks ago. They don't want a wall. I mean, the families come and go from two sides of the border. And a wall won't stop immigrants and won't stop drugs. And it's not really needed in two countries that have so many things in common.
If that were part of the deal,
yeah.
and allowing, you know, a path to citizenship for Dreamers was tied to funding for the wall, are you okay with that?
Well, I'm never okay with things like that, and I would rather have the Dreamers decide that. But the political solution that they had agreed sort of worked. It was, we'll give you 350 miles and of wall, and then you give us DACA. Yeah. I think that's. But here's the difficult thing: the Dreamers don't even want that. Why? It's very simple. Because what we are telling them and what Trump was telling them is, okay, I'm going to legalize you, right? Perfect. But then, I'm so sorry, I'm going to deport your mother, I'm going to deport your father, and I'm going to deport your siblings. I hope you're okay with that. Of course not. No, I mean, who wants that? So the Dreamers, given this alternative of getting legalized in exchange for a few months of the wall, they said no. And I understand that. I mean, they're incredibly brave. They are really taking the lead on an issue, and they're being the strategy that the Dreamers have is completely different than the one their parents had. Their parents, for many years, they understood that being silent and that being invisible was the right thing to do. And they were right. For many decades, they knew that por no hacer ruido, it was the right thing to do. And they were right. But unfortunately, I think they're going to be a generation that is going to be sacrificed. And then the Dreamers came. And then I've seen those conversations. They were asking, hey, ma'am, hey, dad, how come you didn't say anything? How come you didn't stood up when you needed it? And their wise answer was, well, we needed what what was needed to do, just to save you. And it's been difficult, but the Dreamers, they have a completely different approach. It's in your face, bold, radical. Yeah.
And you have written about how you believe that the Dreamers, as well as the students from Parkland,
yeah,
could really change the world, or at least change this country in a fundamental way.
You've seen what they've done. It is amazing. So here we have the Dreamers and the survivors of the student survivors in Parkland, Florida. I live about like 45 minutes away from Parkland. They're doing beautiful things, incredible things. They're in your face. They don't take no for an answer. They're not waiting patiently for change. They're demanding change. And the difference is that, as we were discussing just a few minutes ago, when Columbine happened in Colorado, it is not that the students of Columbine were not as angry as the ones in Parkland, Florida. It is that mass social media didn't happen. We didn't have cell phones back then. We didn't have the opportunity to communicate the same way as we are. And now the students in Parkland and the Dreamers, they have social media. This is the first generation that know much more than the old ones. I'm included in that generation. When it comes to technology, and they're using it to their advantage.
I want to talk about Puerto Rico.
Sure.
You devoted an entire episode of Real America to the plight of Puerto Ricans after Hurricane Maria, and I think it was about 2 months after the hurricane that you were there. What is the status of the recovery? What's happening in Puerto Rico now?
What I saw was an island in the dark. And what I saw was a president who didn't treat the victims of the hurricane in Puerto Rico the same way as the victims in Texas and Florida. What I saw was, again, a president who thought it was funny to throw rolls of paper towel to the victims. And I don't think this is going to change Puerto Rico politically. In other words, I don't think those who believe in independence will gain too much ground. And what has happened is there has been a massive flow of U.S. citizens from Puerto Rico to Central Florida. And that might have a huge political effect. But right now, things are very difficult in Puerto Rico. There's not any desire in Congress to help them with the debt. And things are not going to get easier in Puerto Rico anytime soon.
Yeah. What do you think about the recovery as you look at the state of things there and how long they went without power?
Even today.
So as you look at the future as best we can, how long do you think the recovery will take?
Well, I think it's going to take years.
Yeah.
Many, many years. Governor Rosselló, he wanted to have energy, electricity restored by the end of last year. It just didn't happen, and it isn't going to happen. It is incredibly expensive, and the kind of destruction that I saw on Puerto Rico is amazing. I'm surprised by the strength and sometimes their political patience with the U.S. government. Yeah. No?
I want to talk about Spanish television.
Sure.
And you write in your book about the growing number of Latinos who primarily speak English and that number continues to grow. And so what does that mean for the future of Spanish television and how might you see it changing going forward?
The same way we're seeing a demographic trend in which everyone's going to be a minority, even within the Hispanic community. About the year 2000, something changed. First, the majority of the growth in the Hispanic community came from immigrants, coming from Mexico and Central America, mostly. But then in the year 2000, because we love each other so much, we tend to have a lot of babies. And then the growth of the Hispanic community, the majority of the growth started coming from within the Latino community. That means our kids were being born here. They're going to be voters soon. And they feel much more comfortable in English than in Spanish. I have two kids, Paola and Nicolas. They don't watch me in Spanish. I mean, we created a Univision Fusion, is our first network in English, and that's the only way I can have them watch what I do. Otherwise, they wouldn't know what his dad is doing. And the same thing is happening with young Latinos. Forget about TV. I mean, we are producing TV shows for people who don't even own a TV set. I mean, they watch it on so there's a migration of eyes, millions of eyes, going from big screens to small screens.
And I would like to finish our conversation before we open it up to the audience by allowing our audience to hear in your own voice something very important that I think you wrote about. You talk about the duality that you have to live, right? Mm-hmm. You were born in Mexico, you lived there for 25 years, you're in the United States for 35 years, you're an American citizen, and you write about feeling like you don't fully belong to either place, mm-hmm. and you describe yourself as an amphibian. Mm-hmm. There's a portion of your book I'd love for you to read for us, if you would.
Uh-huh.
And I marked it starting down here, and then I put another mark on the next page where it ends.
Okay. All right. Amphibian is the perfect word to describe my life in the United States. It comes from the Greek amphi, meaning two or both, ambios or bios, meaning life. An amphibian is someone who inhabits two environments, combining two lives. The word itself generally applies to either animals or military operations, but it comes in handy when talking about immigrants. Being an immigrant means living in two places at the same time, sometimes interchangeably or even simultaneously. We come and go between the United States and Latin America, both literally and figuratively. There are times when Mexicans living in the United States spend entire days thinking about what's going on in Mexico, and other times it doesn't even cross their minds. Some people in Mexico refer to me as American, whereas here I am considered Mexican. For those of us with dual passports, the border is simply a symbol. It doesn't really exist. We cross it heading north, we cross it heading south, and nobody stops us. We come from both sides of it. It is a great privilege and a true honor to be part of a country. It is something I take quite seriously. But the fact is that I can instantly decide to be either Mexican or American. When I arrive at Mexico City Airport, I can choose the line that says foreigners or the one for Mexicans. And this decision doesn't require any deep philosophical analysis or carry any inherent feelings of guilt. In general, I travel with both my passports, and I choose the line that is shorter. So that's the philosophical question. That's what determines which country I belong to at a particular moment. The official stamp on my passport shows what I chose to be on that day, but everything can change with my next visit. It may seem strange that I can vote in two different countries, but for me, it's a legal right that I work hard to earn. I have the right to vote in the country that adopted me, the country where my children were born, where I have spent over half my life, and where I pay taxes. But I also have the right to vote in the country where I was born, where I grew up, where my family still resides and receives a portion of the remittances I send. Because of my profession and my personal interests, I pay very close attention to the political climate in both Mexico and the United States. And when elections are held, I know that the results will have very real consequences on my life and the lives of those around me. I am now of two nations. That's a reality. My accent, Chilango in Spanish, and Mexicanized in English, is like one of those leather suitcases that gets scratched by everything it touches, that changes over time and conforms itself to carry whatever is inside it. There are days when I can speak English with no major stumbling blocks, and there are others when I still sound like a newcomer. Sometimes I don't even understand myself. And no matter how much I study and practice, I will never feel as though I've mastered English to a degree that I've mastered Spanish. I sound exactly like what I am, a cluster of flowing currents and voices that collide, mix, and oppose one another. It is impossible to be just one thing at a time. I am many. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. So, So, Jorge, I know that our audience very much wants to talk with you. We have some staff members with microphones. If you would just raise your hands, we'll get a microphone to you. We would ask if you would try to please be brief so we can get as many questions in for Jorge as possible. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Jorge. My name is Nelly Jimenez, and I want to thank you for being here. I also want to thank you because I'm Venezuelan-American, and you have brought a lot of light to that. Can you talk a little bit about what you think is going to happen in Venezuela? What are the things? Because we are in a humanitarian crisis.
Yeah, and let's say that things are as they are. Venezuela is a dictatorship right now, and that means, unfortunately, something really, really tragic. For many years, and you know, and I live with a Venezuelan, you were talking about, Venezuelans were talking about La Salida, which is an exit to the government of Hugo Chavez and then to the government of Nicolás Maduro. And nowadays, very few Venezuelans are talking an exit, a democratic exit to what is happening in that country. And now we are dealing with a real dictatorship. And the challenge is now, what Venezuelans are saying is, how to get rid of the dictatorship. And that's even more difficult than to do it with the votes. Nobody believes at this point that an election can change anything. It was changed from April to May. It really doesn't matter. What we have in Venezuela right now is a true dictatorship. Now, I'm 60. I know that we come from a tumultuous history of U.S. interventions in Latin America, and that is something that I would never, ever can support. I think we've learned from history that doesn't work, and therefore, I think the only solution for Venezuela will come from Venezuelans, and that's it.
Hi, my name is Miguel Andrade. I do immigrant rights work here in Philadelphia with an organization called Juntos. Being here in Philadelphia, we're a sanctuary city. And I also want to add that we became a sanctuary city because of the people, not because of politicians, because we organized to do that. And with all the attacks that are happening with Jeff Sessions and the amount of ICE raids increase and Philadelphia being targeted in Operation Safe City a couple of months ago, I would like to hear from you. What do you think is the role of local municipalities in terms of the larger immigration conversation that's happening at the national level?
And the role of the cities and municipalities is incredibly important, because who's defending immigrants nowadays? No one. So here we have the mayors and the cities like Philadelphia and San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York and Chicago saying no. Again, the most powerful word in any language is no. And what Philadelphia, all of you, and what is happening in other cities is, hey, you know, we're all human beings. No one is illegal. No human being is illegal. And I truly admire and applaud and support what this city is doing and what other cities are doing. Because if you don't do it, who else is going to do it? The mayor of Oakland did something amazing a few days ago. Just imagine the mayor advising and telling undocumented immigrants, be careful, because the U.S. government, the Trump government, is going to start raids and operations in our area. There's nothing I can do about it, but I want you to know. I mean, I think that's very brave. And I think that without the help of the cities, it would be an even more scary time for immigrants. You know what's happening. I mean, some parents are taking their kids in taxis to school because they are afraid that they're going to be arrested. Some people don't want to go to work. Some people are afraid of taking the buses, because now everybody could be arrested with no criminal record. And you know that once they arrest you, it would be an almost impossible situation. So thank you, Philadelphia, for that. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you. First of all, Tracy, thank you for leading a great conversation. And Jorge, it's an absolute privilege to see you. And thanks for reminding me that I need to be brave, too, even when I don't want to be. My question is this. And very early on when you played the video, and it was in Iowa, and there was a point there where I remember when that was taking place, and you could have framed that in the very beginning months ago, or last year, where it was a bully of a television personality, Donald Trump at that time, upset with a television company that wasn't giving him his way. And I remembered that. But as that video played out, clearly you were right in regards to how that turned into a racist situation. When did you know you were right?
We knew we were right on June 16, 2015, no? Se nos pararon los pelos, no? this guy was saying, you're a rapist. What are you talking about, no? You don't know us. You have no idea what you're talking about. And after that, I've done a little research, and it's in the book. Immigrants are less likely to be criminals or to be behind bars. Those are facts than those born in the United States for a very simple reason. We don't want to get in trouble with the police. We didn't come here to kill anyone. We didn't come here to cause trouble. We just came here to work. That's what we want to do. And this might be too technical, but when it comes to felonies, a study conducted by the Migration Policy Institute says that less than 3% of undocumented immigrants commit felonies in comparison to about 8% of US citizens. And those felonies committed by undocumented immigrants most likely have to do with fake IDs. That's the truth. I mean, people use fake IDs to work. So we're great. We're great for the economy. We're not criminals. We're not rapists. Y cada vez que él hable, se me van a parar los pelos, más que a él, ¿no? Pero déjenme decirles algo. Tenemos más pelo y más colmillo que Trump. Eso sí, ¿no?
Thank you, John. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Thank you.
Qué rico es el español, ¿no? Y luego en inglés uno lo champurrea y no le sale uno. I'm sorry.
No, mil gracias. Estoy feliz que estás aquí en Filadelfia. Mira, I started working with deported gang members in El Salvador, mm-hmm. the Mara Salvatrucha and 18. And I continue to work with them in Los Angeles right now through Homies Unidos. And however, I'm here in Philadelphia working a lot with the African-American community. And I wanted to ask you this, there's a lot of similarities to the discrimination that's going on across different population groups. And I believe that the criminalization of the immigrant community is exactly what the African American community has suffered for so many years. That's why the felony rate is higher, because they have been persecuted, the African American community in this country. You probably know the book, A Colony in a Nation. Mm-hmm. For example, do you feel, but do you feel that, especially during this midterm election period, that we need to really join forces and not see us as separate groups, but that we come together and demonstrate there is a huge part of this population that is suffering from this kind of administration that has really is just out of fear that they can't go back to the way things were?
Yeah, I think we not only joined forces, and you are doing that, but we're on the same side of history. There's so much that we Latinos can learn and should learn about African Americans. Look at their voting power. No, they went out to vote, no? and they know exactly how it feels. And let me just make a comparison. Rosa Parks was a hero, and she disobeyed in a very simple but powerful way. And when I see the Dreamers, I see that they are following her example. And because they are disobeying in a very simple but powerful way. I wish we could have more channels of communication, and I think that's missing. I do understand that there are tensions sometimes between our communities, and that should not be the case. That should not be the case. We have so much to learn from each other.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Can I say just one more thing about that? Before Barack Obama was elected, I used to go to schools and talk to Hispanic children, and I would ask them, who wants to be president or presidenta de los Estados Unidos. And just a few kids would raise their hand before Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. After Barack Obama got elected, I would go to the same schools and then to the, with Latino students, and I would say, so who wants to be presidente or presidenta? Yo, yo. Many, many more hands are being raised thanks to the wonderful example of Barack Obama. Think of it. In a country that has faced decades of slavery, followed by decades of discrimination and racism, the fact that we elected the first African American, it is an incredible lesson in history.
Muchas gracias, Jorge. Soy Agustín Guerrero de la Universidad de Pensilvania, estudiante. Mm-hmm. Mi pregunta es la siguiente: es año clave en México en la política específicamente. El cambio en el gobierno mexicano, ya sea a cualquier partido que llegue a la presidencia, ¿cómo va a afectar ese cambio a la relación Estados Unidos contra México ahora que el presidente Trump está en oficina?
I'll answer in Spanish and then I'll go back to English. Primero, tenemos a uno de los peores presidentes que yo recuerde en la historia, ¿no? Enrique Peña Nieto ha sido un presidente terrible, débil, hueco, miedoso. ¿Cómo no se atrevió a decirle en su cara? Primero invita a Donald Trump a Los Pinos. Y luego, cuando lo tiene allí enfrente en la conferencia de prensa y tiene la oportunidad de decir, México no va a pagar por el muro. ¿Cuántas palabras son? 5 o 6. No se atrevió a decir esas palabras. Tenemos un presidente que no habla por los mexicanos y que no habla por nosotros. Y entonces, ese fue el primer error. El segundo es que Peña Nieto y Videgaray se creyeron más listos que el agua tibia. Se creyeron, dijeron, no, hombre, yo conozco al cuñado, yo conozco al yerno, vamos a hacerlo a la mexicana, ¿no? No, déjame llamarle a Jared, dale, ok, sale. Llámale y dile que queremos negociar. No, así no se hacen las cosas. Ese tipo de diplomacia de amiguismos a lo mejor funciona en algunos círculos del PRI en México, pero no funciona para las relaciones internacionales. Y se trataron de ver muy listos negociando las cosas y así no funciona. Así que para nosotros los mexicanos, el muro es una cuestión de dignidad. Es una cuestión de dignidad. No tenemos por qué dejarnos que alguien quiera construir un muro. Si lo quiere construir, que lo pague él. Pero si yo quiero construir un muro en mi casa, ¿qué estupidez más grande que ir con el vecino y decir, tú lo vas a pagar? Entonces, eso es lo que está ocurriendo. A nivel político, el tema de Trump va a ser importante en las próximas elecciones presidenciales porque muchos mexicanos, hay muchas cosas que están mal en México. La primera es el problema de la violencia. El presidente Peña Nieto y el expresidente Calderón han fallado en lo más importante para los mexicanos, que es que no nos maten. Imagínense a dónde hemos llegado. Lo menos que pedimos nada más, por favor, no nos maten. El presidente Peña Nieto tendrá el sexenio más sangriento en la historia moderna de México y ese yo creo que va a ser el factor principal en las próximas elecciones. Pero también creo que va a haber un factor anti-Trump. Creo que un candidato que se vea anti-Trump, con dignidad, que se atreva a decirle en su cara a Trump, no vamos a pagar por ese muro, le va a ir mejor en las próximas elecciones presidenciales.
Briefly. Okay, that was a little more than my high school Spanish could handle. I did catch anti-Trump, but I'm going to ask you, can you translate the question as well and the answer?
Yeah, but I'll be short here. The first, in a sentence, Peña Nieto has been a terrible president, a very weak president who didn't have the courage to tell Donald Trump to his face in Mexico City, no, we won't pay for the wall. For Mexicans, it's a matter of dignity. And then I think the most important thing in Mexico has to do with the violence. Almost 100,000 people had been killed by violence in Mexico in the last 5 years. So the first thing that Mexicans want is, please, don't kill me. That's the most important thing. And I think there's going to be an anti-Trump element in the next election because the candidate who can present himself or herself as anti-Trump might have a better chance to win the next election in July. Thank you. Uh-huh. No estoy llorando, eh?
Okay, yes, ma'am, right here.
Mi nombre es Rocío González y yo voy a la Universidad de Cabrini. Estoy en una universidad que está tratando de traer más diversidad a la universidad. Es una universidad conocida por ser muy blanca. Soy de los primeros hispanos que han ido a esa universidad. ¿Qué es un consejo que tú le darías tanto a los Dreamers o a los hispanos de primera generación y yendo a estas universidades?
Yo creo que lo primero es apliquen, soliciten. Si no tratan, nunca van a entrar. Les voy a contar un ejemplo. Mi hija Paola, cuando estaba solicitando entrar a las universidades, solicitó a todas menos a Harvard, ¿no? Porque me decía, no, papá, es que a Harvard no puedo entrar. Pero ¿cómo vas a saber si no puedes entrar si no solicitas? Las universidades están deseosas de tener gente como ustedes, jóvenes hispanos, mujeres hispanas, que estén ahí. Entonces, Paola finalmente hizo algo, que fue, solicitó a Harvard. Y adivinen dónde la aceptaron. La aceptaron en Harvard. The story that I was telling is very simple. I think we have to make an effort, and we have to try, and we have to make sure that we are there. We do have a problem of political representation. We are about 20% of the population, and we only have 4 senators. Where are the other 16? The same thing is happening at the colleges and universities. Talk to the administrators, and they are always having huge problems making sure that they have at least 10% of Hispanic students. So if you want to go to the best schools, just apply. I was telling them the story about my daughter Paola, who was going to apply to every college but Harvard, because she told me it is impossible that no one, they cannot accept me at Harvard. Well, at the end, she did apply to Harvard and she got accepted to Harvard. And the lesson is very simple. The first thing is you got to try, be a dreamer. Be in your face, be bold, and make sure that you can do it. And I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will.
All right. Speaking of dreamers, we have time for one last question. I know we've got dreamers in our audience. Where's a dreamer who can ask our last question? You, sir.
I have this question.
¿Cuántos dreamers hay aquí? How many dreamers are there? Maravilloso. Muy bien.
My name is Sadrach Diaz. Qué bueno que preguntaron cuántos dreamers había aquí. Mi pregunta, a un placer, Jorge Ramos. Gracias. La verdad, estoy hasta nervioso. La pregunta que yo tengo es, ¿cuál es el desafío de un emigrante latino, especialmente cuando no eres un dreamer, no eres un residente, y llegas a este país con una hambre de triunfar? ¿Cuál es el desafío de un emigrante? Yo soy un emigrante que llegó aquí sin saber inglés, no soy un dreamer, desafortunadamente, pero tengo mucha hambre. Tenía mucho miedo, ya no lo tengo. Uh-huh. ¿Cuál es el desafío, Jorge?
Bueno, el desafío tú lo estás demostrando. El desafío es no callarte, no sentarte, no irte y tratar de seguir adelante. Déjame contarles la historia del doctor Alfredo Quiñones. El doctor Alfredo Quiñones llegó a Estados Unidos como indocumentado. Cruzó la primera vez por Tijuana y lo agarraron y lo echaron para atrás. Y luego volvió a tratar, estuvo levantando jitomate, como le decimos allá en México, por mucho tiempo. Y luego aprendió inglés en el colegio comunitario y luego lo aceptaron en las principales universidades y ahora es uno de los principales neurocirujanos del mundo. Eventualmente encontró la manera, hay muchas, de convertirse en legal aquí. Y ese es el mejor ejemplo. I'm telling them about the example of Dr. Alfredo Quiñones. Alfredo Quiñones is he's a great example to all of us. Alfredo Quiñones came as an undocumented immigrant. He was picking up tomatoes in California. At some point, he went to the community college. He learned English. He went to the best schools. And now he's one of the most important neurosurgeons, not only in the United States, but in the world. So if he found a way to become legal, and to be successful, and I have no doubts that you can do exactly the same. Given the chance of going back to their countries of origin or staying here, my experience is that the majority of the people are deciding to stay here. And at some point, I am sure the United States will do the same thing that it did with me. I mean, the US gave me the chance, and I hope that it'll give the chance to those immigrants coming after me, including you. Thank you.
Jorge Ramos, thank you so much for being with us. Thanks to all of you for being with us today.
Thank you. Gracias.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.